welcome to a rather special edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Special how? Well, today, for the first time, we're broadcasting the programme live from Monocle HQ here in London. We've got a burning question, we've got a panel of great guest speakers to answer it, and we've invited a wonderful crowd of people to watch the whole thing go down. So on the programme today, we are asking, is London still the cultural capital of the world? London is home to world-class art institutions, a famous music scene and an international sea of creative minds, but it has its downfalls too. The city's dwindling nightlife has been making headlines this year. Is London losing its edge? So stay tuned, I'm going to introduce my guests. That's all coming up on the next half hour of Culture on Monocle 24. And suddenly we're live. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Culture Live. I'm Robert Bounds. And for the next half hour, we're going to be talking with our wonderful panel here. Why don't I introduce them? Because at the moment, I mean, and our listeners, our radio, the people on the listening on the radio here, rather than the people that have come to watch us in person, will want to know what we all like look and sound like, rather than just the possibility that we might be a sort of mixed-use boy band ready to do some singing here. Victoria Siddle was never in Westlife. I'd just like to point that out. It's contractually obliged to say that. Jordan Gross is the founder of The Oval Space, which is a wonderful venue in East London. We'll be asking Jordan whether it's an easy thing to run a venue. He's already got his shaken head on. Victoria Siddle is the director of the Frieze Art Fairs, which is obviously it's a London behemoth that's moved to New York very successfully. Sir Nicholas Kenyon runs the Barbican, no biggie. And Will Hodgkinson is the chief rock and pop critic for The Times. We're going to be talking about nightlife, daylife, but not Westlife. Despite the stools. So we're also answering this question, which is London still the cultural capital of the world? It's meant to be a bit of a pointed question. Was it ever the cultural capital of the world? And with recent changes, that's one of the reasons why we're having this discussion. So I'll start with you, Victoria. What do you recommend to London when you travel abroad? You've just come back from New York. When you try and describe the vibe, the cultural scene, and give London a bit of a health check, what are the things you recommend?
In terms of art, I think it's great to look at both ends of the spectrum in London. And that's what makes it really interesting, I think, is the kind of diversity of things that you can see and do. So at one end, obviously, you've got Tate, an amazing new building that they've just opened, and extraordinary museums that are free, which really makes it's pretty rare for a capital city. And I think has helped make it a cultural capital as well, because you can just pop into a museum for 20 minutes on your lunch break if you want to. But at the other end of the spectrum, you've got amazing, vibrant, young galleries all over the city. Used to be more in the East End. Now it's got very expensive in the East End, and they're mostly moving south. But there is this, you know, the fact that it's kind of this migrating group of galleries and artists spreading all over the city means that you can, you know, you can just spend a day seeking them out, and you will see extraordinary things. So I try to recommend things to people that are both on and off the beaten track.
And so your health check, if you were to give London a health check, it would be a clean bill of health, or would it be as to, you know, maybe it has to take out some of the smoking and maybe do some exercise in terms of its cultural scene?
I would say it's pretty robust, right, from where I'm standing. I did a Google check recently of how many galleries there are in London. I thought it was 50, 100. Apparently there are 1,500 permanent spaces showing art in this city. And, you know, considering London's not the cheapest place to have a property, I'm assuming all those places actually have visitors. So I think what it illustrates is this sort of voracious appetite for art and culture in London. And we see that at Frieze as well, where we actually sell out of tickets every day, which is very unusual for an art fair. But there are just so many people here who want to come and see and participate, and that's a wonderful thing.
We'll come to you next. We talked about the fact we're going to be talking about daylife as well as nightlife, and Victoria has been sort of saying there is such a width and breadth and richness in her scene, which is the art scene. We're going to talk specifically about nightlife a bit later, and about things closing, and about tough licensing laws and all the rest of it. But what's your What's your kind of cultural health check on London, I wonder?
Well, if you're talking about live music, which is my field, you're talking about evening life. You know, things tend to go on until about 11 o'clock, start at 7:38. And the situation, on one level, I think it's remarkable that it's as good as it is, because rates are so incredibly high. And, you know, you're always thinking about venues closing down, and yet there's so many interesting bands and so many interesting venues. And I think part of that has got a lot to do with the history of London. You know, I mean, on one level, you're always trying to look forward. But on the other, every single band that walks into the 100 Club goes, oh, my God, that's where Johnny Rotten decked Nick Kent or whatever it was, you know. You know, and or, you know, you walk into Hammersmith Odeon, you think, this is where Ziggy Stardust played his last ever gig. Yeah. And that's so incredibly exciting. I mean, you've got to remember that rock and roll is always going to be quite young. Or live music, you know, dance music, whatever. You know, people starting out generally in their late teens, early 20s. So they soak up all this history. That's got a lot to do with it. But also, it's kind of against the odds that it's still really good, because it's so incredibly expensive. And I always felt that the great thing about live music in Britain and being in a band was that we had this fantastic arts funding called the Dole, which used to go on for years. And all of a sudden they said, you've got to go and get a job. It's now called Job Seekers Allowance. It's the worst thing that ever happened to music in London.
And there's a lot, and of course, a lot of the art scene that begat Freeze, first the magazine, and then the fairs came from that similar vibe as well, the art scene in London in the 1990s as well, right? Okay, you were sort of talking a little bit about history there, and London being good despite itself, and, you know, people wanting to follow in the footsteps of their heroes when they perform at these storied venues, I suppose. Jordan is the founder of a very vibrant venue, and a new one, and one that's thriving. Was that part of the impetus for it? Is it because London's sort of venue history is so rich, you want to be a part of it? Or do you very much see it as a vision of the future, I wonder?
I think that the vision for what we've done in East London is actually come more from Europe than it has from London, to be totally honest with you. So our influence has come more from places like Berlin, places like Amsterdam, and other places in Germany, but also from London. I mean, there have been some amazing clubs and venues that have closed in London in the last few years, and part of the inspiration for the venue we opened last year was a small club called Plastic People that closed a couple of years ago. That was one of my favourite places. But I think London does have a very vibrant nighttime culture, and we're very pleased to be part of that, of course. But it is a bit under threat at the moment, and undoubtedly that's something we're going to talk about later on. You know, later on.
Nightlife, that's the bit of the discussion that will kick off at 11:30, if you can stick around. There's going to be some different music on then. Nick, the Barbican is obviously, it's a famous name around the world. We love it here in London. We're proud to have something of its scale, of its sort of intellectual breadth and depth and all the rest of it. Being in London, does that make it an easier sell for you to attract the great artists from the wonderful shows like Ranja Kjartansson that's just closed, to the orchestras, to all the stuff that happens?
Well, I think we're incredibly lucky, and we are in an extremely privileged position to be able to be at the centre of what I feel is a uniquely thriving cultural scene. We now know, and the evidence tells us, that 70% of people coming to London as visitors come for the culture and heritage. And I think it is a question of old and new. At the Barbican, we go slightly further back than you were saying, as we start with the Roman Wall and the Roman city, medieval churches, livery halls. There's something, you know, on every street corner that engages the visitor. And I think the architecture of London is something that we should not neglect as a really serious part of this whole cultural scene. It's something that really grips people and engages them. And I think what we're saying is culture's always been there in London, but I feel it has been below the radar and too much taken for granted. And I think in the years, particularly since the Olympics and Paralympics in 2012, when there was a real effort to get the cultural organisations to collaborate across the board, make a really strong cultural offer, I think things have really got more visible. Mayors have got behind it, even the occasional MP has got behind it, and I think we're at the stage of getting to a whole new level.
Do we feel that, are we treating it, this is another big question, but I wonder if we're treating it like a business, and that doesn't mean in a bad way, but it means that it has to make sense. It doesn't always have to pay for itself, but it might not be bad to look in that direction.
It has to be a business to the extent that exciting artistic innovation, things that push the boundaries, they have to be worth investing in. And we struggle daily with the issue of how do you justify what you invest in. And as I say, we're very privileged in having money from the city to invest in this activity, but it needs the exercise of judgment every single day of the week to say, is this worth it? And of course, that depends on the response of an audience, but you also have to look further than that. You have to look to the long term in terms of what will bear fruit.
I also wanted to ask all four of you whether you could do what you do anywhere else. And Nick, I'll start with you. He's on a roll, isn't he? I wonder whether you could do, whether there is something essential about London that makes the Barbican what it is, and something that you couldn't do if you worked for a similar institution in New York City or Paris, for example, I wonder.
Well, put it this way, I don't think anybody's going to build the Barbican anywhere else. I've just come back from New York, where Lincoln Center does a job that is not dissimilar to what the Barbican does. Again, it's a high-level operation with very privileged status in the city. But what I think we do that is becoming increasingly important is to get beyond the walls, is to collaborate with East London. That's our direction of travel. That's the part of the city that we engage with. We've got to build new audiences there. I feel London is absolutely the ideal landscape for us to be in. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
Victoria, Frieze, it's got an interesting thing. This is kind of similar to what Will was talking about. It comes from this very lo-fi, the London art scene in the 90s is what Matthew and Amanda started. Matthew Slotover and Amanda Sharp started. That's what kicked them off. So there is a lot of history there, even recent history. It's very much indebted to London somehow. The Frieze is a brand, I wonder. But is it... does its Britishness or its Londonness help you set one up in New York, like you have done an art fair in New York with Frieze behind it?
I think doing anything in New York doesn't really help if you're not from New York.
Yeah,
that was a kind of challenge for us. But New York does feel like the one other city with the same kind of culture as London, and that's why.
Can you hear us, everybody out there?
Yeah.
Victoria's mic's a little dodgy. Yes. Maybe just hold it a little closer to your mouth.
Okay.
I think it's working. I was wondering whether there is something specific about the Londonness of Frieze as a brand, as a magazine, as a fair that helps you to do, that helps you sell it abroad.
Yeah, and we're definitely, the roots in London are incredibly important, and it was 25 years ago, actually, this is our 25th anniversary, of starting Frieze magazine. Wasn't me, by the way, I'm not quite that old. and it does, even though we have a fair in New York, we still run everything from London. Our team's in London, we organise everything from here, I live here, I go to New York a lot, but it still feels as if this is kind of the root of everything, and that works for us. Also, I feel like my experience is on the fair, and the amazing thing was how quickly the city embraced what we were doing and how much they welcomed it and how much the museums in London all worked with us from the beginning to put on their best shows that week.
Yeah.
the galleries all put on their best shows, they all host events around it. It feels like the whole city is kind of galvanised. So it's almost this kind of art festival across London. And that is a hard thing to pull off in many places. But London, or certainly in big capital cities, but London really gets behind it. And it's a great feeling, actually, and would be hard to replicate elsewhere, I think.
Yeah, London used to be so famous a bit. I mean, it used to be so famous being conservative somehow, or it being difficult to turn things around. It seems like people are addicted to changing things pretty quickly, actually. And people do get behind things very quickly. You don't need to overturn an old order, it seems, to get things done, right?
I think that's true, and I think especially in comparison to some of the European cities, for example, it feels like a city that doesn't hold on to its past too much. It changes very readily. And my office is in Shoreditch, and just off Redchurch Street, and it's like every time you walk down the street, there's something different. There's a new restaurant, or there's a new bar, or there's a new hotel, or there's a new shop, or something. And it feels like that very dynamic, constantly changing city where we don't hold too much sacred, which can be a good and a bad thing, but it certainly makes it a good place to launch something new.
I was going to ask that question to everybody. We might come back to that, because that's kind of got us on to a next thing when you talk about how areas change so quickly because your offices are in Shoreditch. I wonder, we can maybe come on to talk about daytime versus nighttime now. And one of the byproducts of the changing use of buildings and things is the licensing laws that go with them. A lot of you'd be mad to live in Shoreditch even 10 years ago. But now those flats are worth a lot of money. What does that do, Jordan, when you're trying to found a space that wants to stay open and has to control its queues and all you know where we're heading with this? I mean, Fabric closed in London last week. 2 weeks ago, yeah.
Two weeks ago.
There's been a lot of editorial written about it. How difficult is it to start up and run a venue in the London of 2016?
I think it's very challenging. And when we started 4 years ago, it was challenging then as well. And you're really talking about, and we started off with a warehouse and just saying, hey, we're going to just take a warehouse, have a half drain pipe for a toilet, and make a bit of a go of it. And over the last few years, it's evolved into a fully fledged venue that we use for a whole range of cultural activities, including music.
The drain pipe is now for sale. It's a rent.
Yeah, it's now for sale. Yeah. You can buy that. Buy that on eBay later.
Beautiful.
So I think it's very, very hard. And it's really a question, two questions really. One is about rents in the city, and other cities have rent control, like Berlin and Paris, where they really protect these kind of institutions. And the other aspect is about licensing. And actually, our experience with licensing has actually always been a very positive one, I have to say. And the police, when we were getting our license, and even now, are very, very constructive and have always been very, very helpful to us. But I think that's also about being professional operators as well. And although I was new to this business entirely when we started, it was always gone about in a scenario where we wanted to be very professional. And we wanted to be as good an operator as we possibly could be. So for us, I actually find that sort of thing's quite relatively easy, I would say. And I think that London can be a very welcoming place from that side of things, but you have to behave yourself, and you have to know what the right things to do are.
People have a funny idea maybe of nightlife, that it's a sort of lascivious thing or something, rather than actually it's a huge part of the economy. London is going to elect a nightmare. Insert your own joke. Is it going to?
I think he's being appointed, right?
He's going.
There are people applying now. Yeah.
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 Who's going to apply? Is anyone here going to apply to be the nightmare? Well,
No, I'm. The hours aren't very good.
Exactly. Technically, I should be asleep right now.
We laugh, but Amsterdam, to give one example, has an absolutely brilliant nightmare who is curating that part of the city's existence really effectively.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, hang on, let's face it, we've only just got a night tube, so maybe we've got time to develop this, but it is an absolutely key part of what's going to make London happen and keep happening in the future.
I'm absolutely not having a go at it. I think it is one of those things that it's such an important part of the economy, and let's not forget the fun of it. Will, are we... You've got a question for
me. Yeah, it's a question, really, to everyone. Why is London so bad at nightlife? I mean, this is, it must have been 10 or 15 years ago when they changed the licensing laws. Try and get a drink after 11 o'clock, you know.
Yeah.
And now the night tube's arrived, but it sort of hasn't, you know. I mean, I don't understand it. Why is London so resistant? You know, it doesn't really make sense, because you go to Paris or Amsterdam or New York, and it's very easy for things to continue, certainly to 1 or 2 o'clock. You know, which isn't outrageous for a city. But in London, somehow, it's, you know, yes, there are nightclubs, which are now facing all kinds of problems. Venues, like I said, concerts tend to finish at 11, theatre and so on tends to finish around that time. I don't really understand why, and I'm wondering if anyone has got any answers to this question, why it's so bad at getting beyond midnight.
Well, I must tell you, for example, in Amsterdam, a new amazing venue called The School opened last year. But that is a building that was found by them, owned by the city. So if you want more vibrant nightlife in London that continues later, the city has to find spaces and buildings that can be used for that, that can be repurposed and used in that kind of way. And again, in Paris, stuff is also protected in that same way, and the same is also in Berlin. And so you want more of it, you've got to protect more stuff and stop people building flats everywhere.
That's the thing, right? I wonder if we've got a night tube, but we don't have anywhere to go.
Or
come back from.
If we're not careful, we're going to end up at the M4 corridor.
The M4 corridor?
Yeah, absolutely.
Would you like to... I wonder if Jordan would like to single out some towns along the M4
no,
corridor.
No, not
particularly
that.
Doesn't
I've been
work.
Specifically prohibited from singling out Slough or Reading.
I wanted
sorry.
You to say it, okay.
I think the GLA is getting interested in negotiating with developers who are building housing developments the provision of cultural space within those developments, along the lines that Section 106 used to provide some public benefit around developments, community infrastructure. And I think the GLA realises that this is a significant problem that they have got to solve.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's essential if we're going to continue. I mean, otherwise we literally are going to end up on the outskirts of London and people won't be able to get there. And actually, I mean, in Paris, actually, they do have a real problem with this. And actually, they are pushing, nightlife has been pushed further and further outside on the outskirts of Paris. And the most vibrant club going in Paris for the last few years has been on a boat on the Seine, which has recently also had its license restricted as well. So, you know, these problems do happen elsewhere as well. We're just not always very good at dealing with them in London.
Do you have challenges, sort of, from local residents?
We work very hard with our residents to make sure that, but of course there were challenges, but we worked very hard on it in the early years. So now
invite them along.
Absolutely, invite them along.
We're having a party. We'd love you to come.
We'd love to come along. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
The upstairs neighbours.
Yeah. So that's the answer, I think. And we would work with people rather than working against them. Yeah. But for us and our legacy in the future, we're looking further east. And we're saying, where can we go which is further out, where we can have more freedom, where we can have bigger spaces and everything else. And that's a very important part of our legacy.
You asked why this is to do with London. I think it's to do with how we live. Because, you know, all those years ago, the Barbican built 3 of the tallest residential towers in Europe in a utopian vision of what an enlightened place for living with the arts could be. On the whole, Britain doesn't want that. It wants semi-detached houses with front doors and gardens.
Yeah.
And that is an absolutely fundamental difference between the urban infrastructure in most of the rival cultural cities that we're talking about.
I hear you on that. This could run all night, couldn't it? There's so much. We have so much to talk about. I've got one last question for this section, and then in 5 minutes, our radio listeners skedaddle. And we stay and we hang out and we ask questions and we have a drink and it's all going to be really nice. So I have one last question, which is, and I won't be turning my back on this section of the audience here. If London has a problem, if London has a problem and a fix, I wonder if there's anything, Jordan, that you see. We've talked about nightlife and all the rest of it. It might be something very specific and tiny, or it might be something huge in general. But we want to kind of leave our listeners and our guests with an idea of being able to fix any problems that London has. So if London has a problem, what is it and how might you fix it?
Well, I think an easy thing would be to realise that nightlife, things that happen, you know, after 8 p.m., after midnight, is a really important part of our culture that we need to all support and recognise in that context. And recently, Bergheim in Berlin was recognised as high culture in
this
the same...
This is a big mega club. I don't know if everyone knows Bergheim.
Well, a very famous techno club in Germany that's responsible for a lot of the music that we do here in London. Recently recognised actually in the tax courts as being high culture, essentially, which is quite made some quite nice headlines over there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so we can learn from Berlin a little
bit. We can learn from that and just try and put it in that frame.
Victoria.
The mayor's office did a study here last year and found that they predict that 30% of artist studios in this city will disappear within the next 5 years, which is a pretty terrifying statistic. 5 years is a very short amount of time. There are a lot of artists living and working in London, and that's what makes it interesting. You know, who wants to live in a city without artists?
And it's difficult to sell out if you don't make it in the city, because it's part of the attraction of
and
Frieze.
They'll all go to Berlin.
Yeah, or Leipzig.
Or somewhere else. And so they have started an initiative to protect artist studio space in London, but it's essential that happens quickly, because otherwise they will just be, all creatives and artists will just be priced out of London, which would be a tragedy.
Yes, a creative is not the same as an artist.
Yeah, right. Creatives make more money.
Nick, what do you see as a problem? How might you fix it?
Well, coming out of what we were just talking about, I think what's missing is connection between the planning process, housing, and the cultural infrastructure. I think there's a fantastic opportunity now. You only have to go to King's Cross and see how Granary Square has enlivened that area and how really intelligent development by an intelligent developer can improve the public realm for everybody. I would like to see constructed connections, open spaces, public realms between our cultural venues so that those things can be joined up as an experience.
Will, what do you... Everyone's nodding along, by the way. I should tell our radio listeners. Everyone's nodding along to each other's answers here, which is a good thing. What's the... If you had a problem and nobody else can help, and it wasn't the A-team, how would you fix a problem?
I'd develop on Nick's point, and I would say that in my, you know, my world of sort of bands and artists and everything, people need rehearsal spaces. Yeah. That's a big problem because rehearsal spaces are disappearing because they are seen as taking up a lot of space. I would say that they deserve a certain degree of protection in the same way that venues are now beginning to be understood to deserve a, you know, so for example, the 100 Club was saved, it was going to be closed down, you know. So I'd say you need rehearsal space. It's just a financial question, isn't it? You know, when London's too expensive, you're not going to be, you know, when people can't afford to live here, musicians, artists aren't the kind of people that, especially when starting out, are going to be able to afford it. But on the other hand, people are incredibly resilient and they'll, you know, be forced to a room if they have to be. But they can't, they have to be able to rehearse and they have to have access to things. Even if it's electronic music, you still need to have access. So I would say that's the key.
Just a final one, a really, really quick one as well. There are a lot of, it's nice to see queues around the block for things. One of the reasons I wanted to ask you some of the questions we've asked in this first half of the show is that you see a lot of queues around the block for art shows that you don't for bands and clubs anymore. And I don't know whether that's because those queues are so much more corralled or whether that's a sign of the times, but that was one of the kickoffs. I think we're going to kiss goodbye to our radio listeners and thank them very much. I've got a little bit of a card here. This looks a bit game show host, but it's actually got words on. We're going to wrap things up. Victoria Siddle, Nicholas Kenyon, Jordan Gross and Will Hodgkinson, thank you very much for joining us today on Culture with me, Robert Bounds. And the show is produced by Holly Fisher and the sound engineers were Alex Funnell and Antonio Fernandez. Sorry, Antonio, made you into a lady there quickly. To our audience here at Midori House, sit tight for a Q&A with our guests right here. And to all our listeners around the world, I'll hand you over to Carlotta Ribello, who will be spinning some tracks, my international playlists, and she's in Zurich. How exotic. So thank you very much for tuning in. We're going to take a little wee break, and then we'll come back with you guys. Thank you.